Okay, let's talk now a little bit more about some odds and ends which we haven't touched on in this unit. One which is brought to my attention, you can start an avalanche on an individual. We haven't even talked about avalanches yet. But you can start an avalanche on an individual by getting to feel a little courage and a little enjoyment, and a little courage and a little enjoyment, and a little courage and a little enjoyment, and you practically gave in quite often. What happens here? Quite simple, what happens, really. You start the little tiny resistance that courage gives, you know, and then a little bit of pull-in, and a little bit of resistance, and a little bit of pull-in, and all of a sudden you got a pressure-tractor combination going here, and it'll cave in the ridge which is preventing the avalanche from occurring. What is an avalanche? You tell if an individual start mocking up acceptable planets or mass of some sort or another, and then go on up into planets, stars, black stars, particularly black stars, and so forth, and get these things roaring in on him from 360 degrees. 360 degrees. Now, that is actually a flow of mass, which is so heavy, however, that it cracks through facsimiles. And there is a little practical application of courage and enjoyment, which is a useful application. It's just something you could do. But beware of that. It's not an end-all proposition. Now, I located and exteriorized a case that was very resistive once by getting into waste courage in brackets and waste enjoyment in brackets. And all of a sudden, there he was sitting there. He was a real rough case, and I have done it other ways, using this same mechanism on other cases, getting him to do things with enjoyment, do things with courage, and that sort of thing. Because it breaks loose the ridge which he's lost in, and produces quite an effect, by the way. It's quite a process. It's not a light process. It's not as senior as the processes you're using by a long ways, but it's quite a process. Try it sometime. It's much more important for you to use 8D or something like that on apathy, hate, terror. If you were just to start in, if you were really interested in breaking up somebody's emotional pattern, boom, you just start using 8D, say, on apathy, hate, and terror, just like that. Bing, bing, bing. And you got a picnic on your hands. There's no doubt about it. It is more violent by far than messing around with courage and enjoyment. More violent, more active technique. Quite permissible to use courage and enjoyment in processing, but again, remember, this starts flows. The only flow that you would care to monkey with would be a flow that had to do with huge mass. And that's hardly a flow. A stream of planets coming in, crash, 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 is hardly a blow. I would say it was a repetitive series of blows. All right. As we go back over the line, we find the admiration particle is quite important in order to understand human behavior. It's not very important in auditing, but it's very important to understand human behavior. Admiration is much lower echelon than courage, nobility, and enjoyment. It's much lower. Admiration is the manifestation which takes place after defeat. Is a manifestation there which is normally when one is confronted with a winning valence, and so on. That's still a high-order particle, you understand. It's way up, it reaches way on up above 20 on the tone scale. But at the same time, you will see admiration in its base forms. It harmonics on down, you see. And you'll see it in its base forms as such things as servility and so forth. And it's true that even higher on the tone scale, it is junior to any kind of purity of force. But admiration has its purpose. It is a solvent particle. So are these other things solvent. What do I mean by solvent? Run at a heavy ridge, they'll tear it to pieces. these particles, launched at a ridge, will rip it to pieces, melt it, make it gooey. And it is, you can say with perfect sincerity and great truth, that that which is not admired tends to persist. A ridge will only persist in the absence of admiration. But that doesn't mean that it's just the absence of admiration that makes the ridge persist. It does mean that the ridge is persisting, and when admiration shows up, it's liable to melt. So you can say about anything that it has persisted along the line in its state, so long as it wasn't admired. Now, you stand around and admire something, it'll start to go to pieces. Let's take this in life. You take this athlete, you know, he's a big muscle boy, and he's real good shape, and he's been out there hitting the line and tearing up the other fullbacks, and, you know, he's having a hell of a time for himself. And then, you know, he went to this sorority dance. After that, he isn't so good. Well, people add it up. They say athletics and sex don't go together. No, nothing to do with that. Guy didn't have any sex. They just stood around and admired him. They admired him. And he melted. It's actually true. They would alter his density with admiration. Oh, you great, big, beautiful man. My hero. See? Fix him up. If I were really out for blood in a game, and I had any great fear of the opposing team, I would just go get me some very admiring young ladies and have them sit around and admire this other team, that's all, and then beat the devil out of them, because their solidity would have dropped on the line. That which isn't admired tends to persist doesn't mean necessarily that everything ought to be admired, then. It does mean, however, that as long as admiration wasn't kicking around in there too strong, you had solid objects. Tells you, obviously, that nobody's really admired this universe very much, because you sure got some solid planets around. And it tells you that an individual will keep on dramatizing the things which are not admired. See, that's no short circuit. Let's say this little kid kept dropping things. His mother kept saying, "What the hell is wrong with you, Roger?" And he dropped some more things. Dropped some more things. He's 25 years old, working in a plant. He drops things. He really drops them now. Nobody ever admired his dropping anything. See? And so he'll bust up more darn things. You know, it's just behavior. He's sort of going around saying, "Look, won't you admire this?" You know, that doesn't matter whether it's a dirty face or anything of the sort. We get somebody who has a consistent dirty face. We find out nobody ever admired his dirty face. Sometimes an auditor can pull an interesting trick just as he's walking around in the society. He will see somebody who has a real bad setup of some sort or another. You know, somebody's gimping around, you know, got a bad leg. Auditors say to him, "My goodness, that certainly is a crippled leg, isn't it?" You know what the guy'll do? He'll just play it to you and say, "You know, it is. Gives me lots of trouble, too." "Oh, I bet you that just gives you more trouble. Gee." You know? Look at it and really admire it. If you're at the same time pouring out a bunch of outflow of admiration, you'll just melt down any facsimile that doggone leg has wrapped around it that's keeping it crippled. That's all. Of course, you're liable to melt down the whole leg, but he didn't need a leg anyhow. Well, very often, if you're dealing with children, particularly where the ridges aren't really fixed, you see some child doing something that is interruptive to whatever you're doing and so forth, congratulate them on it. And they'll look at you rather suspiciously until they realize you're really sincerely admiring what they're doing. And they'll stop it. They'll never do it again. Curious, isn't it? You can just knock out that behavior pattern. Zoom. If mothers realized this, there'd probably be no child there at all. I think the only reason the sexual line keeps on and pregnancy keeps happening and other things of this character occur is because the society doesn't sufficiently admire it. And if everybody uniformly went all out for sex, it would probably disappear as a relay mechanism. It would just go. If everybody decided to admire some terrific characteristic. It's only when they admire it and don't admire it so as to put it up on a big maybe, you know, the thing gets loopy. It gets sort of... All right. Now, another little point here is we have in sex, of course, a compulsive inflow. We have very condensed enjoyment, see? And it is an invitational inflow. I don't care whether it's the male or the female. Sex is an inflow. And watching this, some of the boys had to pick it up as being an end-all of everything, you see, because it is so obviously an inflow. And now that a person has wanted and caused this inflow to occur many, many times, it becomes relatively difficult for him to put something out away from him. You see that? All flows are inflow flows, you see. And now you tell him to throw away one of his aberrations or throw away a mock-up or something of that character, and by golly, he just can't seem to manage it. You know? He gets something out there 2 feet from him and slaps him in the face again. That's too much pull-in. But let's be much more practical about it, shall we? Let's not be quite as theoretical and recognize that if we're really dealing with inflow, we'd certainly better look at eating. There, you're inflowing solid masses. And so you would say eating was more aberrative than sex. Tis, too. You take language in the field of symbols. People inflow on that, inflow on that. And again, you'd say, well, that must be very aberrative, too. That's right. That's right. And you say thinking. You notice these individuals who are real bad off and aren't inflowing anymore. They're just sitting there on a ridge. You know? They're doing a lot of thinking. So that's very aberrative. Anyway, you notice work. You notice all these people that run around in the streets driving. If you've noticed this carefully, they drive these work trucks and things like that. That more work trucks are involved in accidents than passenger cars. These people are all in heavy effort. They're workmen that drive these trucks and so forth, and they are rather dull. They're liable to be tired, they're liable to be overworked, or they're being harassed by a boss and so forth. But nevertheless, it demonstrates that people on that band of effort who are doing a lot of work, it demonstrates that work then is very aberrative. And you notice all these children who have been around emotional parents and so forth, you notice they're in pretty bad shape. Demonstrates that emotion is very aberrative. Isn't that true? And you notice all these people wearing glasses and having a hard time seeing and so forth. And so, obviously, why looking is very aberrative. You recognize that? And you've known cases of individuals who have gone out and they've known some knowledge that proved very, very dangerous to them, you know? You take practically anything you see on television. The detective finds out who the murderer really is, or somebody learns who the murderer really is, and then they get shot. You know? Knowledge, very aberrative. So therefore, we can conclude that the sex up to no scale is very aberrative. And therefore, living and life is very aberrative. We can conclude that. We have basic, irrefutable evidence. But nobody ever looks at the other level of evidence, which is it can't be too aberrative. You're still around, aren't you? And that is actually the final argument to how aberrative is living. You're still around, aren't you? You must have out-survived an awful lot of things. So I guess living was awful aberrative to them. It couldn't have been too aberrative to you because you're still functioning. I explained this to a psycho one time. He practically flipped his case. He managed to assimilate it. I explained to him very carefully that all of life and everything he was doing and everything he ever would do would be just too aberrative for him to bear. And I kept explaining this to him. You'd think under that much impact and inflow, he would have cracked up after a while. You couldn't possibly evaluate for an individual to this degree. But I just evaluated for him till I backed him clean into the wall. And he finally told me as his conclusion, finally, Well, damn it, I'm still alive. I'm still functioning. It isn't that bad. Well, in processing, you start looking for all the things that are wrong with people, and you eventually get to the conclusion that anything under the sun, moon, and stars is highly aberrative. Just look once in a while and see if the precursor is functioning and is still alive after 76 trillion years. If you don't believe it's 76 trillion years, get yourself an e-meter sometime. Sometimes they only tell you 74. They've lost a couple of trillion on the way. But it's all there. All right. I say that jokingly, of course, but actually a Scientologist is being told how bad life is all the time, and he has a tendency to fight it. Well, don't fight it. That's the only randomity that this individual can produce, is finding things that are bad. And that's his main game, and that's his game. When you get all through and all the way along the line, it's a game. How do you make a game? Well, you make another chess player, that's what. Then you forget you're him. And a game has to have two sides. Game always has to have two sides. Therefore, anything which you choose as the other side and so forth has to be fought in some fashion or other, otherwise you don't have a game. And you get two teams, they have to be against each other and fairly well matched, or you don't have a game. And if living wasn't so aberrative, we in Scientology wouldn't have a game. You see that? So there's no particular reason to worry about it. Just remember that if they weren't this bad off, you wouldn't have a game at all. And that's very gratifying to have that many people playing a game that you can be interested in. Very gratifying. You find in this universe the highest order of rationale that you can possibly run into, and we've been trying for years to run into a higher order of one, is that it's a game. And that's that. Only there are two kinds of games. There's the golf game you play because of your health, and you go out and ride around the golf links in a little electric car, very seriously getting out and very seriously swatting the ball and making very hard work out of the whole thing. Well, it's still a game, but boy, he's sure working at it. And then there's the guy who goes out and walks around the links and enjoys being there. And so on. He knows it's fun. Well, the two levels of difference here, which we're mainly interested in, are the people who know it's a game and are having fun, and the people who know it's a game and aren't having fun, and that's about it. They know their games all around, but they're not having any fun. Now, when you get into the aberrated levels, they don't know it's a game and they aren't having fun. Of course, there's a middle level in there. They don't know it's a game and they are having fun. And then they don't know it's a game and they aren't having fun. And then you get fun, game, serious, what? And that's your Los Angeles type case. Anyway, what game? Well, anyway, we have in the frame of mind of the preclear, this is very strongly represented. He gets up, as he comes up scale, into the recognition that it is a game, but it's a darn deadly serious one, you see. And up above that level, he gets up to the point of where he recognizes it's just a game. And then he goes on up to the... And there's the dangerous point. If you were to leave your preclear stuck right there, you'd probably have trouble. But up above that level, why, hey, what do you know? It is a game. See, it is fun. You can do something about it. Well, that's the level you want to push him up into. You will never push your preclear completely out of this computation. I have to have enemies. It's a computation that starts at the top and goes clear through to the bottom. I have to have enemies. Without enemies, he has no game. The main quarrel an individual has on this planet at this time, he doesn't have sufficiently dangerous enemies. There isn't enough here. I mean, there's no reason for you to wear a gun or zap anybody. No real reason. People aren't that mad at you. Of course, you could cook up some reasons, or you could move into the political arena. You could have some enemies. There are lots of false ways you could get enemies where they really wouldn't be enemies, because an individual loves to classify enemies as something you hunt and shoot down and obliterate, because end of a game to a Thetan is nothing there. That's end of game. See, side A times side B. And the winning of the game, half of side A is still there, and there's nothing left at all. It's just nothingness where side B has been. And that's a good, satisfactory game. See, that's a satisfactory game. Most people believe that soldiers and sailors don't talk about the various engagements where they've been in and really had it rough and so forth. Well, individuals won't talk mostly if it's just been quasi-rough. You know, there was three-quarters of the enemy were still alive, and three-quarters of their own troops were still alive, and they took the beachhead and so forth, you know. But if you really got into one where everybody was practically obliterated and so forth, he'll talk, he'll tell you all about it. You'll think, boy, that'd be terribly aggravating. You mean to be in an organization where there are only three men left in this company, and the enemy battalion was wiped out to the last man? That's a nice game. That's a nice game. That was satisfactory. But these guys who get loopy on the subject of war are generally found back at the supply depots, or they are found on board ships which are not taking an active engagement. They're out on the fringe of the engagement, you know. They keep looking over there, seeing there's something still there of their friends and their enemies, you know. And they just keep looking, and they're not an active participant in the matter, and they get an observer complex that drives them batty. You take a soldier who has been wounded out of the front lines and ship him to a first aid station that's within sound of the guns. You patch up a rather serious wound. This fellow's morale's real good. I mean, he's okay. Nothing wrong with him. Now, let's take him and put him in an ambulance or a plane or something, and let's take him back to a base hospital. You see him a few weeks later, and this guy looks like he's been run over by a truck. I mean, he's in horrible shape. His morale is shot, so on. What happened to him? He just was taken too far from the game. This, by the way, is such a startling fact that it has even been observed by past students in psychiatry. Psychiatry has even observed this. Can you get that? So it must be a fact that has the velocity of a 40-millimeter shell. Now, when we get into games in general, let's look at auditing as a game. It's a game which has a certain end in view. Now, the individual who is being audited is supposed to be brought to a certain level of capability. When the auditor consistently fails, or fails once, and then maybe fails a few other times, and only has a few medium victories, he's hung up on the game cycle. The only new thing I'm teaching you this morning. He's hung up on the game cycle. An incomplete game, an incomplete game, an incomplete game. See, pre-clear after pre-clear. Because he doesn't recognize entirely his role in the matter. He is trying to put a friend into the fight. And many an auditor is unfortunately depressed into, I can't have any teammates, which is to say, I have to be the only one. And every time he tries to put somebody into the fight, he thinks he's putting an enemy into the fight. So he'll do something to flip it so that he doesn't put an enemy entirely back into the fight. Now look at this, because it's one of the most important facts in the field of auditing. Are you putting a teammate back into the fight, or are you putting an enemy into the fight? If you're putting an enemy into the fight, you're going to slaughter him. If you're putting a teammate into the fight, why, fine. But it means that an auditor must be able to have teammates. If he can't have teammates, he will very often ruin himself a case. He will know very well the right thing to use. He will remember it 3 days afterwards. And he will use something else while he's auditing. Now, that's a real sad fact. Another thing is, an auditor, thinking he has an enemy there in front of him that he's trying to put back into the fight, becomes entirely confused with the fact that a GE continues to sit there. Now, the auditor himself may have the guy exteriorized and in working condition, in good shape, and so forth, which is to say he actually has a nothingness with which he could communicate, and he concentrates so heavily upon the body of the preclear that he doesn't see that communicationally he's made any great change. The body's still sitting there, you know? Incomprehensible. Although his preclear is in actually very good condition, the auditor starts into slaughtering techniques. I've seen this happen. He will do things to arrest the forward progress of that thetan. Why? The body is still sitting there. Therefore, because it insists on staying there, one must be confronting something foreign, strange, that isn't changing, and the case, therefore, is not advancing. Therefore, you have to know the signals of case advance to know whether you're doing anything or not. Now, because this is a betrayal universe, three-quarters of the preclears that you actually actively help will tell you they have been betrayed. And they'll tell you their friends and your friends that, too. And this continues way on up into the higher level of stratus of case. They will still find something to get betrayed about. You got them over their lumbago, their earache, their arthritis, and yet they say, well, you betrayed me. You betrayed me. You didn't get me up to the point where I could sing like a canary bird. You've done terrific amounts for them. And if you yourself are running on a betrayal computation, you know, where betrayal really affects you and shakes you up, you think you have betrayed somebody, why, you feel that you should do more for them, or something like that. No. An auditor has to be over to be in perfectly good condition, these two computations. The betrayal computation of any kind, where he is affected by all of this stuff about betrayal. You know, he's not just out of effect, but he can take it or leave it alone, you know. And the other one is that he has to have enemies in preclears. The auditor has to be over those two computations. And he has to be in the kind of condition where, one, he can have a game and have teammates. He should be able to, one, have a game, and two, have teammates. Otherwise, he's liable to choose the preclear as his randomity. Randomity is just the mechanism of setting up another side so that you can have a game, if you want the essence of it. And, see that? I mean, just choose something off, and now you've got another player. Same mechanism. Now you're not controlling it, see? So therefore, it can fight you. Automaticities turn into randomities. And here we have this other computation of betrayal. You have to be willing to betray a preclear utterly. Willing to betray a preclear utterly before you will never betray him. Accidentally or otherwise. You have to be willing to betray him before you will never betray him. So these two things a fellow should take care of, betrayal and teammates, because it's the woof and warp of the entire game in which he is associated. And that is the game. And the game uses ridicule and betrayal as its primary emotional weapons. One other factor I haven't mentioned to you is serenity. When you become entirely serene, stand by to have enemies. Because it's a terrible challenge to their dangerousness to have somebody serene in front of them. And serenity will actually dissolve their force particles. You become physically painful to other people when you become serene. Therefore, if you want to play the dirtiest trick you want to play on the human race, if you have anything against it at all, work yourself up the line until you get completely serene. You will have had your revenge. But you'll have more people coming around and raising hell with you and finding fault with you. And preclears finding fault with you in general or finding fault with your auditing if you were simply serene. So why do they talk about betrayal to you and so forth? They try to shake up this serenity. They can't stand it. It hurts. So learn to act a little bit. At least look concerned and be able not to be at all concerned. And you got it.